Hi, this is Michelle Sherman, president of MissureX Pharmacist Consulting Services and the host of the Conscious Pharmacist podcast. As far back as I can remember growing up in South Africa, one thing was always obvious to me. It was something that emanated from my soul, if you will. It was the knowing that all human beings are created equal, that we are all the same. The Conscious Pharmacist podcast is proud to be a podcast on the Pharmacy Podcast Network and is a show for pharmacist healthcare providers who have answered the call to practice on purpose. Being conscious brings to light disparities and injustices in our society and healthcare system. Our show strives to bring to the forefront these issues we face today in a changing healthcare landscape and how we can change lives one patient at a time. As pharmacists, we do what matters, how we practice what matters, and how we take care of patients matters. Be conscious. Speak out. Every voice matters. Be the change you wish to see in the world.
You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. You're listening to the CRX Podcast. The CRX Podcast provides an added benefit for healthcare professionals and readers of the CRX Magazine, a leader in reliable information and news about medical cannabis. The CRX Podcast will provide the latest discussions about cannabinoid products as part of a patient's treatment plans and deliver the latest education about medical cannabis for pharmacists, physicians, and innovative healthcare providers.
Hello, everybody. This is Joseph Friedman, pharmacist with CRX Magazine. What we do is we do podcasts based on past and future articles in the magazine. And today we're talking about a very important topic. I've got a couple of great experts on board. And again, I'm Joseph Friedman, pharmacist, with CRX Magazine. And so I've got Jessica Cranny and Simi Burns, two dynamic people who are very knowledgeable about this topic. And Jessica, why don't you tell the audience about yourself?
Thanks, Joseph. And I really appreciate you having me. I work in the cannabis industry. Insofar as the consulting and recruiting side, I spent 16 years in very traditional telecom retail leadership and transitioned that into the cannabis industry, working for a large vertically integrated operator here in Colorado. And about a year into that, found myself getting recruited by other companies to take that traditional enterprise experience and bring it to cannabis. And so for about the last 2 years, I have spent the vast majority of my time consulting with and recruiting for cannabis and what I call can adjacent companies.
Excellent. And then Simi Burns, who is a fellow pharmacist, PharmD, I believe. So Simi.
Yes. Hi. Yes, I am Dr. Simi Byrne, PharmD. I am a pharmacist. I've been a pharmacist for about 11 years. And I primarily worked in long-term care, nursing home, assisted living, geriatrics. And so lots of pain management, lots of chronic illnesses. And I kind of got to where I felt like, is this all there is? Is this all that we have to offer for health for people? It seemed to be very much focused, the whole industry and the medical system in general, focused on profiting off of prolonging people's suffering. And so I got into holistic health and wellness and did some health and wellness coaching. I am a yoga and meditation teacher, opened my own yoga studio here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the more that I got into holistic health and wellness and plant-based living, plant-based nutrition and plant-based medicine, the more that I learned about cannabis that I had not learned in pharmacy school other than a little bit of prohibition propaganda. So that started my my interest there. And I do consulting as a medical cannabis pharmacist for individual patients, especially with chronic health conditions or complex medical conditions where they've got lots of medications. I get a lot of questions from parents looking for support for their children, and work on numerous projects and partnerships that I'm really excited about, from research to education in the medical cannabis industry.
Fantastic. Well, let's just jump right into this. And then again, this topic is about the Last Prisoner Project. And if people don't really know or aren't familiar with that project, it's a small nonprofit that is spends a great deal of time fundraising, but at the same time, what they do is, you know, there's a huge population of people out there that have been incarcerated for nonviolent crimes. And, you know, one of those nonviolent crimes is, you know, being put away for possession of cannabis. And there's about 40,000 people that are, you know, incarcerated today for, you know, nonviolent crimes. And I just signed a clemency that is going to President Biden. You know, in his first day of office, I think he released about 12 people, but, you know, it's not enough. And what we need to do is get a lot of these prisoners released. We have to have clemency, but we also need to have cannabis descheduled. I mean, this should not be on Schedule 1. And for a lot of those people that don't know what Schedule 1 is, it's just the illegal schedule for all drugs that have no medicinal value, are highly dangerous, and just, you know, can't be prescribed by doctors. So with all that said, let's go get right into this. And so, Simi, you know, how did the war on drugs disproportionately affect racial minorities? So in other words, how did the war on drugs specifically affect, you know, Black Americans?
Right. And I think that is such an important question to lead with, because, you know, the war on drugs is a tool. It is a project of white supremacy. It is a project of anti-Blackness. It is a mechanism by which that happens. And it starts from, and it impacts every area of society, everything from education and the school to prison pipeline. Before I was a pharmacist, I was a high school teacher. And you see that, you know, starting very early in life for Black and brown children, where they are prepped and prepared and over-policed, and all of these things going on, from everything from mental health to poverty to all of the problems that already disproportionately affect Black and brown people systematically in this country are going to tie right into that. So, you know, it's really the more I learned about it, and the more I learn about the racism baked into not only our prison industrial complex and the war on drugs, but also our healthcare system, our medical paradigm, fundamentally, the more confused I am as to why this isn't a bigger topic of conversation in healthcare. I've done a lot of work in Medicare for All and healthcare justice. You know, that's something we're talking about a lot. This is a public health issue. The war on drugs is a public health issue. It's causing public health crises of various kinds, which are continuing to feed into it. So I'm really glad to see more conversation, and there needs to be more work and more attention to the Last Prisoners Project and other advocacy and organizing within industry, within the healthcare profession, within the cannabis industry, and the public in general.
Great. Jessica, do you have anything to add to that?
I totally echo everything that Simi has just said. And when you look at the numbers, you really can't discredit the data. Across our country, Black Americans are almost four times as likely to be incarcerated. And in some states, that's up, you know, over eight times as likely. But yet the consumption across both races is very parallel. And so, you know, like I said, I echo everything that Simi said. And when you look at the data, to her point, the need to continue this conversation, and you said it as well, you know, 12 people released on his first day of office is certainly a step in the right direction, but it's not enough. And we need to continue to do more and, you know, continue to amplify not only the medicinal properties and, like you said, descheduling, but amplifying what happens racially.
Great. And you know what, the Last Prisoner Project, you know, let's get a little bit into that. You know, again, I mentioned that it was a nonprofit small group. And, you know, I guess the question that I have is, you know, why does it take, you know, the Last Prisoner Project, you know, to be the only one out there, you know, trying to get support for these incarcerated prisoners? You know, why is this project necessary, and what took us so long? So Jessica, do you have any comments about that?
Well, I think the necessity of it is one that we just kind of touched on. But to your point, I think that there are organizations starting to get involved and in line. And, you know, when I chatted with Mary last week, you know, she started the team, as you mentioned, with her and two people, and they've now grown that team to over 13, but they still have, you know, great opportunities and options for people to get involved, to continue to amplify. Yes, there's sponsorship packages, but there's also things that you can do at little or no cost to just raise that awareness. And, you know, there are a few organizations. The ACLU really tackles it from a minority perspective or a race perspective, versus a lot of states' normal organizations, NORML, is trying to tackle it from the deschedulization and legalization side of things. But, you know, the Last Prisoner Project has definitely been the people that have been beating the drum the loudest.
Right. And Simi, why is, you know, I mean, it's great that we're seeing some movement in this area, but there's, you know, going to be record expungement. You know, why is that just as important as getting these prisoners released?
Yeah, I mean, because the impact of incarceration on people it ripples through the whole community, through their family, through the rest of their life, from being able to vote, from being able to get a job, from being able to reenter society, from the cycle that's there. And it's big business. People are profiting off of this entire system that, you know, from prison labor and for-profit prisons, those are things. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world. This country has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And in fact, in Oklahoma, where I am from, we have the highest incarceration rate in the country. So that makes us the highest in the world and highest for women in our state prisons as well. And more than half, depending on what year, more than half of those are for drug offenses. Two-thirds of those women in prison are mothers. Oklahoma incarcerates disproportionately, like all states, Black and women of color. And so that has to be part of it. We can't say that we care about health and wellness in the medical cannabis industry without caring about the way that the prison system and the war on drugs impacts health and wellness. We can't say we care about that as healthcare professionals. We should stand up for that as healthcare professionals. We should know about it and we should realize the impact of that. And, you know, it's appalling to me here in Oklahoma. I can walk into a dispensary that looks like an Apple store, yet people are languishing in prison for doing exactly the same thing just a few years ago or outside of the legal market. And it's just, it's hypocrisy. It's unacceptable. And more people need to know about it.
And, you know, one of the things that kind of, you know, comes to mind is, you know, and I think we briefly talked about this is, you know, there's opposition out there. And, you know, this opposition, I mean, what we don't know, and there's some big opposition organizations, you know, where is their funding coming from? Is it coming from these profitable prisons? You know, are they getting donations, you know, to keep cannabis at a Schedule One and keep these people in prison? I mean, you know, do you have any insight on that, Jessica?
Yeah, a couple of things. And I wanted to touch back on something that Simi had said regarding, you know, just when I was chatting with Mary last week, one of the things that she said that I quoted, I underlined, I circle, circle, star, starred, was she said, this is a real moral imperative for me personally. She said, I'm a consumer myself. I have been before it was legal and I was lucky enough to not get caught. But so many people weren't, you know, afforded or whatever, however you want to, I don't know if luxury is the right word. But to your point about, you know, work, Simi, and getting back into the workplace, I actually worked with a company here in Colorado that I was very impressed by this. It was certainly something that, you know, they took to heart as a social imperative for them. They go and they post job openings at local correctional facilities that basically say, if you've been incarcerated for cannabis, we have a job for you. And kind of doing their part. And so I think there's things like that continue to happen for folks, you know, like myself and like Mary, who say we've been participating and didn't have this happen to us. To your point about funding, I actually looked up a statistic. States waste over $3 billion per year enforcing marijuana offenses. And to your point, it's not usually drug kingpins. It's, you know, all consumers with, you know, a couple of pre-rolls or an eighth or two in their pocket. And there's the amount of money that we're talking about spending. And when you think about how differently that money could be spent, you know, rehabilitating people, providing resources. You know, I love Simi's points about mental health care, general physical health care. Like, what could we be doing differently with those funds for these very nonviolent criminal offenses, quote unquote criminal?
Right. And you keep on mentioning Mary. Did you actually, you know, so Mary's with the Last Prisoner Project. What is her position there?
She's one of the founders.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, then she's, yeah, she's got some insight, I'm sure. From the standpoint of, you know, these, you know, people that are getting out of prison, and I think you touched on this, Jessica, but Simi, you know, what kinds of things are needed, you know, by the federal government or in individual states to really help these people who are getting out of prison, you know, reenter, you know, society?
Yeah, I mean, I think that has to be a comprehensive approach, because we can't treat the event of going to prison and coming out as like an isolated thing that just affects one person. It affects the whole community. It affects everybody around them. It affects all of us, children in particular, you know, with the percentage of women in prison and the percentage of women that are mothers in prison, and parents, mothers, fathers, just parents who are unable to be part of their family's lives during that time, and unable to be, you know, it's setting up generational supply to the foster care system, to the prison system. And this is big business. This is very profitable. That's why, you know, in healthcare justice advocacy work, I learned that, and this was really baffling to me, that because the prison system has for-profit entities, some of them are not even American companies. So there's companies that are, you know, from other countries that have Americans and people in America in prison for profit. And that's their business model, is collecting more money than they spend on prisoners. And so because healthcare is part of that, they do better and benefit when prisoners are healthier, which means younger. And because of shifting demographics, that's more likely to be Black and brown people, because of the changing demographics of the American population. So these systems, so my point to that, to just a roundabout way, I mean, these are huge problems to tackle, and it's going to require everybody. In particular, I would love to see more conversation about that in the healthcare, if, you know, for healthcare professionals, and really looking at, like, for example, the reasons that people use cannabis, and how they are related to systemic racism, from PTSD, from the impact of stress and trauma on the body, from chronic inflammation, you know, for mental health, for all of these things. You know, why are we imprisoning people for trying to feel better using plant medicine that people have used for centuries in all over the world, safely and effectively? It makes no sense to me clinically, medically, as a pharmacist, as a person, and it shouldn't to anybody else.
Great. And Jessica, are there any other programs out there or groups that are working towards similar aims, you know, similar to the Last Prisoner Project?
I think in a roundabout fashion, as I mentioned, kind of from the minority perspective and the race side, the ACLU, you know, has kind of an arm of theirs that is dedicated to correcting some of the things that have happened as a function of the war on drugs. And then most states, their normal organizations are working on kind of the legalization and the deschedulizing. But as far as kind of really tackling incarceration related to cannabis and how that's impacting, you know, races in a variety of fashions, I really think they're, like I said, kind of beating the drum the loudest on that one.
Right. You know, one of the other factors contributed, what are the other factors that contribute to inequality and incarceration rates? I think, you know, that's sort of a common sense, you know, question with probably a common sense response. But Simi, you know, what do you think?
You know, I really like and the perspective of a physician, Dr. Rupa Maurya, about the ways that these systems work and how they impact our health. Because, you know, a lot of times we like to think about racism as something that happens when somebody is mean to somebody else or has like mean thoughts about somebody else, and something that happens between individuals or things like that. And it's really not like that. This is about systems, and these systems have an impact on living human beings, on our bodies, on the body level, on, you know, on our health. And it's really violent. And so, you know, that probably kind of digressed from your original question there. But I mean, I think that one way that I really like that Dr. Maria frames it is that we have to start looking at things more holistically, the way that Indigenous people have done for centuries, and quote unquote modern science is kind of just now catching up, that we're not separate systems. We're not an immune system and you know, an education record and a parent and, you know, a community member. We're all of those same things at the same time as full, complete human beings. And so when these things happen with these systems, that leads to chronic stress, leads to inflammation, and what she would describe as diseases of colonization. So in Indigenous cultures, suicide is very rare, cancer is very rare, heart disease, you know, a lot of these things are results of these systems and not living sustainably and not living the way that we always have for thousands of years up until the last few hundred years. So this isn't natural for us. And there we have to be able to imagine a path forward and what that can look like. And I think that really looks like digging into our roots. Plant medicine is one of them. I'm, you know, very passionate about that and returning to the planet when it comes to food, when it comes to medicine and ourselves.
You know, and just, you know, to your point, just a couple of years ago, the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program, you know, did some statistical analysis and they compiled it. And cannabis offenses in 2019, there were more cannabis offenses, you know, than all the other violent crimes combined, including rape, homicide, aggravated assault, and armed robbery. And, you know, 92% of these arrests were for simple possession. So what other kind of policy changes, you know, local, state, or federal, Jessica, do you believe would help to work toward a solution? You know, what do we need to happen?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that we're doing right now is continuing the conversation and just providing a platform to continue and drive ongoing awareness. And one of the things that Mary had touched on, you know, there's three different programs or opportunities to get involved and be a part of the conversation. And there's a few different really creative things that I think that, you know, they've continued to do to help amplify. And I can get into that as much as you'd like. But, you know, I think it is ongoing awareness, and there are a lot of people who don't realize that this is an issue. And, you know, Simi makes a great point. When I think about my sweet mom, when she walks into, you know, a dispensary, she's not thinking that people are incarcerated for this anymore. It looks like an Apple store. They've all got polos on. It's a legit business. And yet there's not a lot of awareness for people that have been negatively impacted, whether you're a longtime consumer or a newer consumer. And I use my mom always as an example because she's admittedly naive and I've educated her along the way. But I think there's just a lot of lack of education out there. And so ways that we can continue to amplify that.
You know, that's a great answer. And, you know, to that point, you know, we've got this growing cannabis industry. There's lobbyists out there. There's, you know, Normal that you mentioned. And what can we do as an industry? I mean, what kind of responsibility or role can, you know, should we play from this standpoint? So, Simi, you want to start that? And Jessica, certainly chime in.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be a leading voice, a loud leading voice to that, because, you know, it's immoral. it feels very wrong. So from everything from employment, I loved what you were talking about, Jessica, about making sure that people who have been affected most by the war on drugs have the most opportunity or more opportunity. And unfortunately, it seems to be going in the opposite direction. And I think people need to realize as well that just because there is decriminalization or, medical marijuana programs in certain states, or because of those things, people are still getting arrested and imprisoned, incarcerated for cannabis, even in states where it's legal, because if you don't have, if you don't have the right license, the right paperwork, I mean, it doesn't make it go away. And we're still adding people to that system right now. So I think that's something that people can be aware of. And knowing more about it, I wanted to highlight, and one of the, there's a lot of stories on the Last Prisoner Project's website, and one of the stories on there that, because a lot of times people are thinking drug dealers, oh, that's bad people, organized crime, it's really not like that. This was Fate Winslow, September 2008, a 41-year-old houseless father in Shreveport, Louisiana, undercover cop, asked if he could buy him $20 worth of marijuana, and he offered him $5. For the service. So for $5, that's what he was going to make. And he was, homeless, and was I couldn't at that point turn anything down. I was trying to turn my life around. But because he had had three strikes, and Louisiana has a four strikes, really harsh law, he ended up being incarcerated. And the white drug dealer was never arrested. Fate is a Black man. Fate Winslow. Yes. And so Last Prisoner's Project got him released. That's the kind of people that they are working to help and to connect with, even writing letters to and letting people know that we care. We're here on the outside. We know you're in there. We're working toward it. And they ended up getting his release. But unfortunately, he passed away 5 months later. So he was in a maximum security prison for a small amount of plant, really, we're putting people in cages over plants that people have used medicinally for thousands of years. It is what it is. And I think that people have a hard time wrapping their mind around that, because the more they learn about it, the more hard it is to believe. And I think that feeds a lot of the, just conspiracy theories or just a lot of confusion. And so I think it's up to the cannabis industry and the medical industry, the healthcare industry. I would really like to see more conversation among physicians, pharmacists, people who are supposedly caring about health and well-being, because this is, I would say, racism is the biggest public health crisis there is.
Interesting point. And Jessica, you've got a lot of ties to the cannabis industry. What do you have to say?
I mean, I like I said earlier, I echo a lot of what Simi said, and I like the way that she talks about the ripple effect and the need to really take a look at it holistically. And I totally agree with that. I think that if you look at it with just one lens or very myopically, it's not going to paint the picture that is the reality. And I think Simi touched on that very well. When you hear the word drug dealer or the phrase, there's a certain image that comes to mind. And to your point, it is very much house moms and, just regular Americans having, like you said, enjoying in many places what is now recreationally legalized plant that's been around for thousands of years. I hearing that story, really, those are the things that I've done a ton of research. I've chatted with them. I didn't come across that story. And I have chills. Those are things that people need to be aware of. And especially when you make the comment that the Black gentleman was arrested and the white gentleman wasn't, that's a glaring issue. And if people can't see that, it's time to remove the blinders.
Mm-hmm. And to add to that point, Jessica, I totally agree. And, the war on drugs makes it easier for police to stop people and to harass people and terrorize. I would call that police terrorism. It's not protecting and serving. It's particularly targeting certain communities and certain individuals based on systems. And so, that has to be looked at very deeply. Is smelling weed, is that cause for searching somebody or for creating a dangerous encounter that may well cost somebody's life? That's we really need to look at what kind of society, why do we think that we need so many police everywhere all the time around our children, around us? Why is that normalized? When, you know, all we get taught this idea that, oh, like in America, it's very violent, but as we were saying how, you know, cannabis or for simple possession, not even like huge drug dealing, simple possession arrests, more people arrested for cannabis than the violent crimes like rape, homicide. So, you know, what are the police? Why do we need so many? Why do we need robocop police when healthcare professionals are wearing trash bags in a pandemic?
That's great. And you know what? We've got, you know, a number of listeners out there that are healthcare professionals and patients alike. So guys, or girls, what in what way can our listeners help? You know, so listeners, listen to this.
Sure, I'll go ahead and start. There were three things that Mary had shared with me as far as ways that people can get involved and give back. One is just general people and citizen donations. She shared with me that over 30% of their funding comes from individual contributors like you, me, and the listeners of this podcast. And so if there was a desire to get involved, we absolutely can help from a charitable donation perspective in that front. They also do two really cool things that they provide to companies to demonstrate a partnership or the company's commitment and partnership with Last Prisoner Project. One of them is the Partners for Freedom Project that offers sponsorship packages. The most common one is $12,000 a year or $1,000 a month. And as a sponsor, you are highlighted on their website. You get a few different marketing materials. There's things that you can, you know, put out there on your social media as well that say, hey, we're locking arms and we're running with this team. The other thing that I think that they do is really cool, that's at no cost to the company, but really helps with amplifying awareness, as we were touching on earlier. They do what's called Roll It Up for Justice, and it's entirely free to a cannabis retailer. It allows customers to donate from their transaction. And so think about if you go to Red Robin and they say, do you want to round up, you know, for the American Cancer Society or what have you, this is an opportunity to round up for the Last Prisoner Project. And so even if a company doesn't want to necessarily write a check or that kind of contribution, there's, you know, if you were a consumer in that dispensary and didn't even know that this was an issue, but you know what happens to be that you've got a cousin or a brother or a sister or an aunt that is incarcerated, you're going to roll that up. That difference up. So they're doing a few different things that we can do to help continue to amplify. And the other thing she asked us was follow us on social media and repost our things. You know, if I can go find that story or see me, if you can send that to me, I would love to, you know, continue to help amplify that. So she talked a lot about awareness. They certainly appreciate and enjoy charitable donations to help their cause continue. But they're looking for advocates like the three of us, you know, here on this podcast and any of the folks that are listening out there.
Fantastic. Well, you know what, we're sort of getting to the end of our time here, but I wanted to, you know, see if you had any, you know, parting words, you know, how people can get a hold of you. So Simi, why don't you go first?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Dr. Simi Byrne. I'm on LinkedIn and my website is cannapharmacistok.com, cannapharmacistok.com. And I would love to connect with others in the industry, especially healthcare professionals. I think that a big thing is the stigma and educating ourselves so that we can help break the stigma around medical cannabis, around all of these issues, and really seeing racism and all of these interlocking systems as not just something that one nonprofit does or a law can be passed to fix, that it really has to be about engaging where you are in your own community. Do something, get involved with something, whether it's, you know, the Last Prisoner Project, whether it's a job training program, whether it's just educating yourself about white fragility and reading white fragility and then doing something about it, whether it's writing letters, it's going to take everybody a lot of work. So I'm really glad to be here and have this wonderful conversation with you, Jessica and Joseph, and really appreciate it.
Thank you. And Jessica.
Very similar comments. I'm also on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram, Facebook. Our website is grnuptown.com, and would love to connect with, you know, as Simi said, cannabis professionals, medical professionals, frankly, folks that just kind of give a damn. about what it is that we're trying to do here. And I think Simi's point was spot on. Get involved, do something. It doesn't have to be a lot. One of the Last Prisoner Project websites that you can kind of direct to is an opportunity to sign petitions and let your voice be heard, you know, at the government levels. And they provide a platform for that. And you can pick different petitions to sign, and that doesn't require anything more than a little bit of time to say that, hey, we're with you on this one and we support you. And so I think Simi said it best, just continue to be an advocate, continue to amplify it, educate yourself and educate others.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Simi and Jessica. You know, I believe we've been able to deliver a lot of good information and really make a point on how serious this issue is. Clemency is one thing, and expungement is another, and then descheduling is certainly another. And we need the federal government to just get real. So with all that said, again, this is Joseph Friedman with the CRX podcast. Stay tuned. We've got some exciting podcasts coming up in the future, and certainly, reach out if you have any questions. Thank you all.
To find all the episodes from the CRX podcast, go to crxpodcast.com. To learn more about the latest advancements in medical cannabis, visit crxmag.com. That's CRX. MAG.com. Thanks for listening.